It's Thursday, November 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up, U.S. and Turkey began joint patrols in the area of Manbij, Syria. Some Google workers stage protest around the world against sexual harassment, and scientists offer suggestions to advance the search for life in the universe. It's all ahead. U.S. and Turkish forces have begun joint patrols in the area of Manbij, Syria, where Kurdish militia fighters have been critical to defeating Islamic State fighters. Two U.S. defense officials and Turkish officials confirmed the patrols in northern Syria today. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb joins us live with details. Hello, Carla.
Hi, yes, Kim. I am just learning from U.S. officials that these patrols were carried out northwest of the city of Manbij along the demarcation line. That is the line that divides the territory controlled by the Turks with the territory controlled by the Manbij Military Council, that is the U.S.-backed locals around the city. These were highly anticipated patrols. They followed weeks of rehearsals and training in Turkey, and the United States and Turkish forces had conducted more than 60 what they call independent but coordinated patrols since June 2018.
So what about the timing of this operation? Why are they doing this?
Well, this comes at a very unique time. While this is going on in Manbij, down in Deir ez-Zor, the Syrian Democratic Forces there temporarily suspended their offensive against Islamic State, and they said that they suspended this due to recent Turkish shelling. In the area of Kobani, Turkish forces struck several Kurdish militia targets earlier this week, and so the SDF said that they fired back in what they called was self-defense, destroying a Turkish military vehicle. And this is really bad for the United States and the coalition, because Turkey is a part of that coalition, and the Syrian Democratic Forces are the partners that that coalition is supporting. So having these two groups, who are both supposed to be fighting the Islamic State, attacking each other is really bad, and that's why we saw Army Colonel Sean Ryan, a spokesman for this counter-IS coalition, calling for a de-escalation, and the United States has been reaching out to both of their partners to try to get this to stop.
So what kind of contacts then have taken place between the U.S. and Turkish officials regarding this plan?
Well, we know that President Donald Trump and the Turkish president spoke about Syria today. We do not yet have the details on that call. This was breaking news. But we can imagine that these two hotspots are going to be discussed, because the coalition has been stressing that the Islamic State has been removed from 98% of its territory in Syria. They are pushing that the remnants are being defeated, and that it's just a focus on the remnants. But they're saying the transition is going to be locals taking the security, not the United States, not any outside country, but locals. And if the locals are sick of fighting because of influences from the outside, then that can collapse the entire plan against the Islamic State. So it's very important that both of these groups, the SDF and Turkey, stop fighting each other. And that's why you see these joint patrols starting with the U.S. and Turkey in an area that has Kurdish fighters that the Turks do not always get along with.
Okay, great. Thank you, Carla, for providing us with this latest development. That's Carla Babb reporting from the Pentagon. And here are some of the top stories trending. Indonesian Navy divers say they have recovered one of the black boxes from the wreckage of Lion Air Flight JT-610, which crashed into the Java Sea just minutes after taking off from Jakarta early Monday morning. Russia imposes sweeping financial sanctions on 322 members of the Ukrainian elite and 68 companies owned by prominent Ukrainian businessmen. Australia's controversial refugee settlement deal with Cambodia has expired and is no longer an option for the immediate future. And China is exporting its methods of strict internet controls to governments around the world that are employing them to stifle dissent and information and tighten their grip on power. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis. Coming up, Human Rights Watch calls for immediate action to stop what it says is widespread sexual abuse in North Korea. Well, hundreds of Google employees, most of them women, are expected today to walk out of nearly two dozen company offices around the world to protest the company's handling of sexual harassment cases. They will also protest against its workplace culture. The walkouts are the latest indications of employee dissatisfaction that escalated last week after the New York Times reported the internet giant paid millions of dollars in severance pay to male executives accused of harassment without disclosing their inappropriate conduct. Michelle Quinn is VOA's Silicon Valley Bureau Chief. Speaking from San Francisco, she tells International Edition's Sarah Williams about the planned protests.
The spotlight's been on Google for a long time about the number of women working there versus the number of men. I think the latest thing I saw was that maybe 30% of the workforce is women. And then if you look at technical roles, there's even fewer women. And if you look at management, it's pretty slim, too. So this has been an ongoing issue. And I have to say, Google's been working on it for a while. But a series of disclosures about sexual harassment, and particularly payouts to male and superstar employees when they were found to have credible evidence of sexual harassment, has really sparked this protest that's going around the world. It sounds like everybody in each time zone is leaving their office if they support this protest at 11:10. So it's creating this sort of, Google is, more than 50,000 employees around the world, so it's creating this sort of around the globe experience.
And this protest is basically, is it like a short walk-off?
That's right. My understanding is that it's a short walk-off. People speak, and then they go back to work. But it's still pretty striking if you could think about this is a non-union or non-industry where there's not an organized way for employees to speak. What happened was that people created this group inside Google, and it's called Google Walkout for Real Change. So people created the group and organized just using internal Google messaging and then also Twitter. So in an industry that doesn't have a union, the fact that employees are coming out is really, really interesting.
Well, apparently one of the cases that got a number of Google employees upset was involved the former senior vice president, Andy Rubin, who apparently was paid $90 million when he left the company.
Yeah, I mean, Andy Rubin is a legend in Silicon Valley. He worked at Apple. He was at this company. He's been this person who's had these ideas about mobile operating systems. So he's been with Google, and he's really been the kind of push for Android, which is Google's mobile operating system. And he, allegedly was accused of sexual misconduct and allegedly was paid $90 million in severance, even after there was Google has termed a credible finding of sexual misconduct. So, I mean, he is a superstar. I don't know if he would have been paid $90 million if this allegation hadn't surfaced. But the fact that people here are saying this is not okay, we can't treat our superstars like they walk on water. There needs to be consequences. I think that that's what today's about. And then I was looking at the people organizing the walkout have kind of created their like 5 points of what they want to change. And one of them is to basically make a public disclosure of sexual harassment every year. And it's, Google's already sort of famous for It has a puts out a transparency report every 6 months saying, you know, which government asked it to take down links, the number of times law enforcement has contacted them. But this is something that the employees are asking for. We want you to report publicly about sexual harassment. And that's pretty interesting.
VOA Silicon Valley Bureau Chief Michelle Quinn reporting from San Francisco. Well, Human Rights Watch calls for immediate to stop what it says is widespread sexual abuse in North Korea. In an 86-page report released today, the group says its 3-year study of the issue has found that abuse against women is so common it has come to be accepted as part of ordinary life in North Korea. The Human Rights Watch report follows a July 2018 white paper on North Korean human rights published by the Korean Institute for National Unification. The white paper reported women are easily exposed to domestic violence, gender-based exploitation, and violence in society and the social conditions where women can be protected from such violence or seek relief are found to be lacking. I spoke with correspondent Steve Miller in Seoul, South Korea, about the report.
Human Rights Watch conducted an extensive 3-year study, what they call, as far as they are concerned, one of the most expansive study on sexual violence against women in North Korea. And what they say is that the problem is really so pervasive that a lot of women in North Korea view sexual assault and the ordeals that they have to go through as routine, a fact of everyday life. And Human Rights Watch says that those that perpetrate violence against women come from all walks of life within the North Korean side of things, whether they be soldiers or policemen or guards. It's not just party officials that are conducting these alleged atrocities.
Is the government acknowledging that this is happening?
Well, the North Korean government says that there is no problem of sexual violence in North Korea. And Human Rights Watch says that the reason for that is that because women face such obstacles in reporting violence, that even though in North Korea there are criminal codes on the books against rape and different sexual violence acts against women, because they face so much fear of retribution that they simply don't report it. And since there are no crime stats, North Korea comes out and says, well, there's no violence. There's no history of violence in North Korea, no widespread sexual abuses taking place against women. Human Rights Watch, with their reporting, says that simply is not the case.
And so what does Human Rights Watch, what do they want the international community to do?
Well, they really want this issue brought forward and hopefully with greater discourse, let North Korea know that in terms of addressing this issue, what Kenneth Roth says, he's executive director of Human Rights Watch, this is something, in his opinion, that Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, could fix, quote-unquote, tomorrow, because this isn't an issue that would take away his grasp of power in North Korea. It simply would, you know, improve the lives of women in North Korea if he enforced the laws on the books, if he took the problem seriously and made concrete changes to address the issues that have created the system in North Korea.
So at this point, is there any way a woman can feel empowered to come forward to let people know that this is what's going on, this is what's happening to her, she's being sexually harassed in her country in North Korea?
According to the research that was published, there's really very little that women in North Korea can do. The researchers spoke to over 50 people who had left North Korea about their experiences. And these are people who had left North Korea after 2011. Now, this is after when Kim Jong-un came to power. So these are all fairly recent defectors and refugees that they spoke to. And they told horrific stories about they would be put in these detention holding cells. And there's one story that really sticks out in the report about how this woman would hear this clicking sound. And that's the sound of the locks being turned over in the detention cell. And then they would have to wait to see if a guard would come to them. And if that happened, they would have no choice but to go with that guard and then, you know, unfortunately be assaulted. So there's really no recourse for them while they're in North Korea because of the fear of retribution.
That was VOA correspondent Steve Miller in Seoul, South Korea. Well, President Trump says as many as 15,000 U.S. troops could go to the Mexican border to stop caravans of Central American migrants, many of whom are seeking asylum from crossing into the United States. Trump's 15,000 number is far more than the roughly 5,200 active duty soldiers the Pentagon is sending to the border, along with the 2,100 National Guardsmen already there. U.S. Defense Department officials told VOA that about 2,000 additional active duty troops will be placed on standby to help the active duty troops already assigned to the border. This would make the total number of troops deployed to the U.S. southern border more than the number of Americans fighting terror groups in Iraq and Syria. About 14,000 U.S. troops are deployed in Afghanistan. Jennifer McCoy is a political science professor at Georgia State University and former director of the Americas at the Carter Center. She tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Trump is making illegal immigration a big campaign issue a week before the November 6th congressional election.
He believes that this is the way he can energize his base to vote and the way to win. He's focusing on it now, in particular, before the midterms, and continues to talk about it for political agenda and to distract attention from other kinds of messages. The Democrats, on the other hand, are trying to focus on health care and make that their primary message. The reason, I think, for this focus, the caravan happens to be coming at this point in time, but immigrants are coming, you know, regularly into the United States. This is overall a relatively small number, and overall immigration has dropped in recent years of people seeking to enter the United States, and border apprehensions have dropped as well. So it is not the crisis, the alarming crisis, that I think the president is trying to make it out to be.
President indicates that the migrant caravan members, if they do reach the U.S. border, will be provided tent cities, apparently along the border, until their asylum cases are adjudicated. Is this extraordinary?
Well, in the past, they have been allowed to come into the country, make their asylum claims, and remain in the country while those asylum claims are assessed. So keeping them outside the country would be new. Under this administration, they have been allowed to come in up until now, those who were allowed to come in. Not many of them have been turned back as well, but those who were allowed to come in and then detained. And so that was a new step as well, detaining them rather than processing those who requested asylum and keeping track of them while they were free to, you know, to be on their own accord, awaiting their asylum claim. So yes, it seems to be each step of the way getting a new tactic that is a more restrictive tactic.
And what do you attribute the decline in illegal immigration from Central America?
After the Great Recession in 2008, immigration from, particularly coming from Mexico to the United States, started to fall off. And in fact, Mexicans started returning to Mexico because there were no job opportunities in the United States. So that was the beginning of it. And then during the Obama administration, there was a very high number of deportations. And so, you know, the U.S. has been cracking down on illegal immigration. And as well as the economy grew in Mexico, you know, people were more willing and, you know, interested in staying there. Now, the Central Americans are fleeing particularly violence and gang violence. So it is not the same kind of economic opportunity that they are seeking. They're really running for their lives from Central America. And that's why we see such large numbers there, because the gang violence is growing in countries like Honduras.
That's Jennifer McCoy of Georgia State University. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Savor the flavor of African music.
Africa, oh, Africa.
I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is International Edition. Well, the United States Congress has a big question for the National Academy of Sciences, or NAS. It wants to know, are we alone in the universe, or are there other planets like ours with intelligent life forms out there? NAS has been working with scientists across the country to answer that question. Erica Celeste caught up with one of them at the University of Notre Dame.
The Hubble telescope has given us spectacular pictures from space, but they're not detailed enough to help us in our search for life in the trillions of galaxies across the universe.
If tens of percent of stars have planets that could resemble the Earth and could potentially have life, then the implications are that there are billions of them just within our Milky Way galaxy.
As a member of the NAS Committee on Exoplanet Science Strategy, Justin Krepp is focused on how and what the United States will explore in space over the next decade. In September, the committee released a report detailing several recommendations to do just that. First, it encourages NASA to develop and launch a space-based mission specifically to image and characterize Earth-like planets around the stars. But that's not easy.
If you try to image a planet, you run into several difficulties straight away. One is that their separation is very small on the sky, so you need a certain size telescope to do that. The problem is that Earth's atmosphere blurs out the images, and so it exacerbates that problem.
The committee believes the NASA mission, collecting data from above the Earth's atmosphere and more powerful equipment, could resolve that issue, which leads to the second recommendation, building two large ground-based telescopes that will produce images 10 times sharper than that from those of the Hubble Space Telescope. The highly sophisticated equipment will also help scientists with another recommendation, completing the partially funded Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope. When launched into space, it will not only search for planets hundreds of light years away, it'll gather information on what they're made of and if they could support life. That, Krepp says, could answer an age-old question.
Are we alone? This is a question that impacts not only science, but theology and philosophy and other areas. And so it's a curiosity. It's part of being human. Is our world special? Is it isolated? Or are there other planets out there that could have life? Can we communicate with them?
Other recommendations to start to answer those questions include building state-of-the-art equipment, developing a network for teams around the world to collaborate, and creating an investor program to fund it all. The report will be reviewed by the U.S. Congress and used in the federal plan to search for new planets and extraterrestrial life over the next decade. For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in Notre Dame, Indiana.
And that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and thanks for joining us.
Is one of the oldest and most popular beverages in the world. While it's difficult to pinpoint exactly who was the first to brew the frothy concoction, historians generally agree that the brewing and drinking of beer and similar drinks can be traced back to about 5 to 7,000 years ago. U.S. and Israeli scientists say they have found evidence that suggests beer was brewed in the eastern Mediterranean area several millennia before that. The researchers from Stanford University University in California and the University of Haifa in Israel studied and analyzed three stone mortars that were found in an ancient burial cave site in Israel. They say their analysis confirms that the mortars were used for storing food and for brewing a wheat barley-based beer that was probably served at ritual feasts some 13,000 years ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.